Welcome to the New York Jazz Workshop podcast, everyone. I'm your host, CJ Shern. On this episode, I'm very proud to present to you a conversation I had with drummer and composer Antonio Sanchez. Mr. Sanchez has been one of the leading lights of the drum scene for the past 20 years now, almost. And on January 26th, he releases his new album, Lines in the Sand, a powerful lament on the plight of the immigrant in America. We spoke at length about the album, its production, and the individual tunes. I would like to thank Antonio Sanchez for his generous time at the Jazz Views with CJ Shern Studios for this interview, as well as Jill Amaral of Dog and Pony Industries. Remember that the New York Jazz Workshop podcast is just part of what the New York Jazz Workshop does to increase the scope of jazz education in the greater New York City area. Here is my interview with Antonio Sanchez. Antonio, thank you for joining me once again for the New York Jazz Workshop podcast. And it's a bit different this time because we're actually in person. Mm-hmm. And we're in the Jazz Views with CJ Shern studio. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, as always.
Sure. So, we talked a while ago about Bad Hombre, and now you have a new album, which is the follow-up to Channels of Energy with the WDR Big Band, mm-hmm. called Lines in the Sand. And this is really a powerful, powerful record in terms of documenting the experience of being an immigrant in America. So let's just talk a little bit about this record.
Yeah, well, you know, as you can imagine, this is another record that is pretty personal to me, just like Bad Hombre was, because of what's transpiring in this country right now with minorities, immigrants, women. I mean, I think this administration has distinguished itself because of its lack of basically empathy towards all these different people. I mean, the only real empathy that I've seen from the president seem to be like white supremacists. You know, those are the ones that are always being lifted, you know, and or at least not blamed and not put on the spot where they should be. So, like I said, it's a personal album, but the way I've been introducing the shows is that this is not a record about me, because I'm an immigrant too. I'm Mexican. I was born and raised there. I came to the States when I was 21, and I really have not much to complain about, you know, and really in the general sense of the word complain, because I've been incredibly lucky. You know, I have a family that has always supported me. My mother was always in my corner helping me out. And I was able to come here legally to do something that I wanted to do. You know, I didn't have to leave my home because of any terrible reasons. You know, it was just to pursue my dream. So the way I've been introducing the album and the show, the way I've been talking about what this album is about, is that this is not about me. It's more about the immigrant that lately especially has been politicized, demonized, ostracized by a few very powerful people in the name of some very twisted nationalism that is eroding the core of one of human beings' basic characteristics, which is to feel love for other human beings that are different than you are, and to feel empathy for other human beings that have less than you are, the less fortunate than you are. So this album is about that kind of immigrant, you know, that has been fleeing persecution, famine, war, violence, and, you know, is basically what has been happening lately with, you know, refugees, people coming from South America, from Latin America, that they, if they stay home, they're going to get killed. because of gang violence, because of drug violence. They extortion people, and if you don't pay them, they just kill you. You know, as simple as that. So, I mean, I would be running away from that if that was my situation, you know, in my home country. So I think it's so horrible that we are just closing the doors literally and figuratively to all these people that are really struggling just to stay alive, you know, and denying them the opportunity to have a normal and better life. I think it's just the principle of that is horrible.
It really, truly is. And I have a friend from Venezuela, and she was talking about how horrible the situation is over there.
Yeah.
And the album really is powerful, especially the way it begins on the intro to Travesia, with the sound of an immigrant child being taken away.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
it's chilling with like the sound of the tinnitus and everything. And at the end, it's like the beginning of a movie almost.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wanted to start the album in a very, for lack of a better word, just striking. It's a violent introduction to what the album is going to be.
It really
and
is.
And what I did is I just grabbed a bunch of different sound bites from people being stopped by immigration police, by ICE, or by regular police, just based on racial profiling. Some of these people were even American citizens, and they were just being stopped because they looked like they might not be from here and not have papers. So I wanted to start the album that way just to kind of shock you a little bit and make you wonder what's coming after that. And that was, you know, when I heard the whole thing of the intro, and I added different sounds to make it a little bit more dramatic. Yeah, it's you know, it's horrible. Every time I usually when I want to listen to the record again, I kind of skip it because it's frightening.
You know? Yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned that because when I listened to the record earlier today, I almost skipped that part because it's so powerful. And unfortunately, Tana was unable to be with us today, but she was born in New York, but she's of Croatian heritage. And I think she grew up in Croatia during the time of the terrible events there in the early 90s, right?
No, she actually moved there a little later. And it was because her parents wanted to reconnect to their Croatian heritage. And they wanted the kids to experience that. And so she was there during her teenage years, which were, of course, as we all know, very important years. And, you know, we're married. She's half American, half Croatian. I'm Mexican, and I'm naturalized American. So we're constantly wonder what it would be like to raise children right now in this country, in this climate, that are half Mexican, half Croatian, half American. Well, I mean, a third of each. So it would be, you know, we're always thinking about, okay, what's the best thing to do? Should we try to have a family here and deal with everything that is going on right now, or try to go somewhere else? I don't know. It's just hard everywhere. Even if you have the choice of going wherever you wanted to go, you know, it's not like it's beautiful everywhere except here. You know, most places have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting and an unfortunate time.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is a very unfortunate time, because I think in my 37 years on the planet, I don't think there's ever been a president who's done the kind of things that this one has.
Yeah, by far.
And even though I didn't agree with some of the other past presidents like George W. Bush and things like that, he never went as far as doing some of the divisional tactics that this particular president is. And it's really a throwback, I think, to Hitler era Europe or Stalin era Italy, you know, things like that. And people are just kind of numb.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of, I think the shock is kind of dissipating a little bit, and now we're getting into territory like, okay, what are we going to do about this? You know, I think at first we were in disbelief, but now I think it needs to be more practical. Like, okay, how are we going to deal with this from now on? Because we all know now election meddling is a thing. Not only from the Russians, but people are starting to do it everywhere because they see that it works.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just fake information, misinformation, just a wave of misinformation that is permeating so much of our everyday life and our social media. And it has big, big consequences, as we've seen, you know. So, I mean, going back to the album, this whole thing is just kind of my take and trying to make sense of all the craziness that is going on.
Yeah, and in terms of the music, it's a phenomenal record.
Thank you.
And I've been following your career, as you know, from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the artistic growth, it's just, and I think I said this the last time out too, it's just astonishing. And this record, I thought the last one, the Meridian Suite, was incredible, and it is, but this one just kind of raised the bar. And I think about your work with Pat Metheny. It's like the Meridian Suite was like your imaginary day, and then this one, Lines in the Sand, is like the way up. It's really pushing new territory. And
yeah, well, you know, it's one of the amazing things about living in a place like New York and being around incredible musicians all the time, that it kind of makes you grow very quickly, exponentially, and it raises the bar very quickly. I feel like if I'm not doing something all the time, I'm really lagging behind. I'm like good for nothing. You know, because there's so many people that are so accomplished. I mean, just being in the presence of Pat, you know, Pat Metheny, for so long, you know, I feel like such a slouch, you know, because he just goes and goes and goes. And when you look at his career and what he has accomplished, you know, it makes you feel small in a good way, you know, because it pushes you to try to strive for that kind of achievement.
Yeah, he's got 5 new projects now that are pending release, and I'm really looking forward to what that might bring. But, you know, in terms of this album, it's pretty much the same band as the Meridian Suite, except you have on tenor saxophone now Chase Baird on tenor and EWI. So talk about Chase Baird, who replaces Donnie McCaslin from the last record.
Well, it was actually Seamus Blake
Seamus Blake. And that's right. Donnie did play the gig that I saw.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, Seamus is an amazing player and he's been around for a long time and he's got an incredible voice. But it was more of a logistical decision more than anything else because he kind of moved to Europe. You know, he's doing a lot of stuff over there and he's doing well. So, you know, I just wanted somebody that would be more available and that would live in the States just to make things easier on everybody. And especially because the music that we're playing is not music that, okay, we can just get together for a couple of hours and rehearse it. You know, it needs to be very detailed.
Oh, yeah.
So Chase actually subbed for Seamus in like 3 gigs that we did in Europe. Was it last year, I think? And, you know, he learned the Meridian Suite by heart. You know, he kind of knew it better than anybody in the band.
Wow.
So I was like, well, you know, this guy obviously is putting a lot of work into it. And I appreciated that. And now all the new repertoire, he also, you know, learned it by heart. And that, you know, that's one good thing about it. But mainly he's got incredible, he's going to be an amazing voice in the scene. I think he has so much potential. He already is playing incredible. He's doing great.
Yeah.
I did his record with Brad Meldow and Neil Felder, and that should come out next year too. And it's a great record.
Oh, wow. I can't wait to check that one out.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
You know, and I noticed too, like with the tenor playing, there's always been, at least in my view, like a strong link to Michael Brecker. And like yes. The Michael Brecker influence is palpable. I recall when you posted the teaser of Bad Hombres and Mujeres, somebody had commented that his solo sounded like Michael Brecker during the 80-81 days.
Yeah.
And just a really, really ferocious player. So is that Michael Brecker sort of edge and influence something that you're consciously looking for, or is it a subconscious?
I think it's subconscious, but I mean, the amazing thing, one of the amazing things that I loved about Mike was the way he just like took music and just made it his, and just in a very, you know, aggressive way, almost. So mm-hmm. I love it when players have that edge when they're aggressive, because I'm an aggressive player when I play. So I especially, there's been a long history of relationships, strong relationships of tenor and drums.
Yes,
you know, and that's one of the things that we both drummers and tenor players like to do, which is playing duos. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's just drums and saxophone has something. I'm not sure why, but starting obviously with Train and Elvin, you know, or Sonny Rollins, he would do like all, you know, really long duets with Tootie Heath, you know, and that would be something that would influence, you know, my way of thinking consciously or subconsciously.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And Chase has that fire in him.
Yeah, he really does. And the forward aggressive playing, I mean, I love that. Like, as a listener, I always gravitate towards guys or women who play ahead of the beat, on top of the beat, lots of forward momentum. Like Jimmy Smith is like one of my all-time favorite musicians, my first favorite musician, and he was always playing like on top of the beat and ahead, and you know, that just creates like a general momentum. And I think if I was a drummer myself, I would probably be very aggressive and ahead of the beat too, because that's just the kind of thing that I like. But Chase adds an incredible fire. And then Tana on this record is just superb as well. I mean, there's a real growth in her conception since her own first album 3 years ago. And now on Gene S's most recent record, her growth there is astounding as well.
Well, just wait until you hear her record.
Ona, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
That record is an amazing statement. She really grew exponentially as a composer, as an arranger, and as a singer, and as a musician overall.
Yeah, and you know, her sound is a big, big part of this new album, particularly since she's been using a new looping device, a new effects device for quite a while, and it's just adding this new texture. And she posted some videos of your live performances in London, and talk about what you were talking about with Train and Elvin and the kind of intensity that you like from Chase. I felt like when you were duetting with her, I felt, man, that's what Train and Elvin would sound like now in the 21st century, in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to have that kind of communication with her, of course. But this record in particular, I think she's a lot more integrated into the album. The first thing she did with us was New Life, where she just guessed it on the track, New Life. And I loved it so much that I was like, man, it would be so nice to just get the voice all over the music. And in the Meridian Suite, there was a lot more, of course. She was really part of the band. But now, with the effects and the looper and all that stuff, she is not only a singer, she's also an instrument.
Mm-hmm. A horn.
You know? Yeah, a horn and a synth.
Yeah.
You know, she does stuff that is so atmospheric and cinematic that a lot of times I'm not even sure where some of those sounds are coming from. between her, John Screed was playing Rhodes with effects and distortion and stuff, and then Chase having the saxophone with effects, and then having the iwi. Sometimes the sounds just and also, you know, Matt and Orlando, who did the Orlando Le Flaming, who did the this past tour, but Matt Brewer also has a bunch of pedals on with the bass. So then sometimes it's this thing that gets created that, you know, I don't think we're even sure where some of those sounds are coming from, and it's really, really, really cool.
I love that. I mean, just some of the organic. Well, it's just very organic, too. It's not like those sounds are coming from a synth. They're totally musical, and they fit into the music. And there's so many textural things on this record that are incredible. Just like on Travesia, there's a section with the cello and the viola, which that's like a really rocking, killing part.
Thanks.
And what was your inspiration for that when you wrote that particular section?
Radiohead. The last album they did, which is A Moon-Shaped Pool, it's got strings all over it, and I've been listening to that for quite some time now, and I love the way they use the strings. You know, it was just kind of, you know, it doesn't permeate the record, but when they come out, it's just so beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wanted to, you know, it just happened. You know, I was writing and I didn't exactly know what to do after this certain section. And then I was like, oh, man, it would be so cool to do strings. And then I just started recording MIDI strings just to see what it sounded like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, it would be great if we could do that. And then I realized, you know, I have my own little studio now. So I had them over and Elad Kabilio and Nate Schramm. And they just re-recorded a bunch of different parts and sections, and all of a sudden it sounds like an orchestra.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing with home recording technology today. I mean, with this whole rig that we have set up for the interview, you can really do things that now that were only really possible in big studios, but now you could do that at home.
Oh, yeah.
No, and it's
amazing.
I mean, you remember with like Pat's thing, back in the 80s, he used to do everything on the Synclavier. And, you know, now with all of the technology that's available, it's a natural outgrowth of that. And you don't have to spend $25,000 to do what he did.
Yeah. So now, you know, at home, I do so much post-production. You know, if I didn't really repeat any or replace any drums, but I could if I wanted to. And, you know, Tana did a lot of overdubs. I did a lot of overdubs too. And all the post-production, all the mixing, I do at home, basically. I mean, Pete Karam helped me mix, but we didn't even actually get together. I would send him my mixes, and then he would just work on those and then send them back to me and keep working. So it was very self-contained.
Yeah, there's a lot of beautiful kind of like sub-mix type details on this record where you can hear.
Yeah, I mean, that became, you know, production has become an instrument for me, too.
Yeah.
You know, for example, this is the first time, like, Bad Ombre was my first foray into production, really. I mean, I had done it in the Meridian Suite, but it was very, you know, sparse and very subdued. Bad Ombre was all about production, you know. But this is the first time on this record, on Lines in the Sand, that I used, for example, delays and echoes and stuff like that as an instrument for the drums. So, like, for example, I would spike up a delay on a snare hit, and then you would hear it repeating, you know, and I just thought it was beautiful, musically speaking. You know, that it would just enhance the music in different ways that, you know, otherwise it's impossible to do.
Yeah, and in headphones particularly, those Beyerdynamic DT70 Pros were really great headphones. You could really hear, like, the details of, for example, your drum might be dry on certain sections, and on the next few bars it'll be wet, and like the reverb will like pan to the right or
yeah,
to the
yeah,
left.
I did. That's another thing that I've been really getting a kick out of, just panning and how separating different things, doubling things, but on both ears.
Oh, it's great.
And you know, the way I do records nowadays, usually, especially with migration, is I program everything really well on Logic. Mm-hmm. And then I export all that stuff to Pro Tools. And then, you know, basically I know exactly the duration of the tune, what it's going to be. I know the structure perfectly. So we record with a click, and every section is completely mapped out. So that's wow. That's very useful. But what was really cool is that I kind of produced the demos a little bit, and they sounded pretty good. Then I record real drums on the demos just to get a feel for, mm-hmm. for what it's going to be like, mm-hmm. and for me to create my own drum parts. But then the cool thing is that I ended up using a lot of the sounds from Logic on the recording because they were already there. And for example, all the piano parts were already there. And sometimes I would just throw in the Logic piano part, and it would just double what John Screed did. And all of a sudden it sounds twice as big.
Wow.
And then pan them, you know, one on each ear. And all of a sudden you're not exactly sure why it sounds bigger, but it just does.
Yeah. That almost reminds me of... like when you listen to Pat's Letter from Home, most of that is actually the synclavier. Mm-hmm. It's just he added the rest of the group to fill out
exactly.
the other parts, but most of what was there on the record was there right. in like the pre-production phase.
And what you were talking about, the strings, it was the same thing. I used a lot of the programs, program strings to kind of beef up the real strings. And if you hear just the strings without the MIDI strings, it sounds great, but it's not as fat. And then if you hear just the MIDI strings without the real strings, it sounds fat, but it doesn't sound that great. You know, so it has to be a very fine balance for it to just sound better. You know?
Yeah, it would be because I'm kind of like a nerd when it comes to hearing like details and mixes. I would love to hear like some of the raw material and how it
I'll show you the demo someday.
To the cool. Cool. Back to the music. Probably one of my favorite pieces on the album has to be Long Road.
Mm.
Because thinking about it in terms of the perspective of immigrant families and things like that, you get the sense of feeling what they have felt. But in terms of my own journey as like a disabled person and living on my own in my own apartment and all these other things, I feel like that song kind of, something about it just resonated with my own journey. Mm. And
yeah, I think it kind of portrays some kind of longing. You know,
yeah.
That's to me. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Something. I mean, it's. I think it's hopeful, but it's also introspective.
Yeah, and also a technique that you use in that piece that I love so much is the melodic development, where you just take like a fragment and just keep building on it
mm-hmm.
over and over and over to the breaking point. Like for example, in your stuff with Pat, for example, a tune like Wherever You Go or We Go On,
right.
that kind of building of a certain fragment. And I was trying to count the bars of what that melodic fragment was, but how many bars is that in
Long Road? I think it's seven or nine. I can't remember. I would have to think about it. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the record starts in a very dense way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So as we talked about, it's first that intro with the voices and the police and stuff, which is pretty intense. And then Travesía starts, and that's a 22 or something like that minute tune with a lot of sections, very intense. You have to really kind of pay attention.
Yeah.
And then Long Road comes, and it's really simple, It's very, very simple. It's mm-hmm. just this melody that just kind of keeps repeating, and it's just this, I think, seven or nine bar phrase. No, I'm not sure now. That keeps kind of looping, and the melody is very, very, very simple, and it just I want it to be kind of hypnotic, you know.
Yeah, and the vocals loaded with like tons of reverb. Like I love that from, you know, Pat's thing and like various ECM recordings that's sort of in the distance.
Yeah, that and also the doubling of the voice and instruments in general, but especially the voice when you double it and then you pan it or you don't pan it. I mean, you just get this warmth and this thickness. And, you know, even and when it's the same person doing it, in this case, Tana, of course, then it has this magic added to it that I love.
Yeah, and of course, your vocals are there too, quite far down in the mix.
Very far down.
Lots of reverb, because the reverb, knowing myself, having started to kind of sing some more myself and practice some things to cover your imperfections, you can use a lot of reverb.
It helps a lot.
And it'll cover up that... Yeah. That thing.
it will cover the mediocrity in us. And then in some other people, it will just enhance the beauty of their instrument.
Yeah. And then, of course, Bad Hombres and Mujeres, that's kind of a new look at Bad Hombre.
Right.
And
so that's one thing that after doing Bad Hombre... You know, I mean, for people that haven't heard the record, Bad Hombre is basically just kind of drum improvisations that I started chopping around and then producing after the fact. And I did it all by myself in my studio. But there were some motifs, some bass lines, some things from the record that I really liked, but they're not really tunes. They're more like vibes or, you know, sonic adventures, mm-hmm, whatever you want to mm-hmm. call them. But there were some elements from that I was like, man, I would love to build tunes, actual tunes around those elements. So the first one was from Travesía. I don't know if you noticed that the arpeggio that it starts with in 9, that's exactly the same arpeggio as 9 Lives of Bad Hombre.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I like that arpeggio and I liked what it did with Bad Hombre, but then, you know, I was like, let me see what I can build around this that is a hypnotic thing that kind of goes throughout almost the whole tune. And that's from 9 Lives.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask like what the time signature was, because it sounded to me like either 7, 9 or 11.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 9. And what I like about it is that even if you don't know what time signature it is, you can kind of start singing it in your head while you're listening to it. Mm-hmm. And then everything around it makes sense. If it was just like this empty 9 with all these things that if I would have removed the arpeggio, then you wouldn't have anything to hold on to. So the arpeggio kind of is the glue that puts it all together.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of on the Meridian Suite, there's a kind of line like that.
I love arpeggios. Anybody that knows my composing style can see immediately. Like, oh man, this guy uses a lot of arpeggios. Because it's driving. You know, it's driving, and it gives you a lot of the basically all the harmonic information you need, but you know, it's just spelled out in a different way.
Yeah, and Bad Hombres and Mujeres, what I love about that is the dueling iwi solos, and they just kind of explode into this echoey thing into the universe.
Right.
That's
iwi and prophet that John played.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah, I love that because it explodes into your drum solo. And you hear the sound of the room, which is like so cool. I love the sound of the room on the drums.
Yeah, that tune is also, you know, it's called Bad Hombres y Mujeres because it's based on the tune Bad Hombres from the record Bad Hombre. So the bass line, basically. The bass line is the whole tune on Bad Hombre. But I like the bass line a lot, and I wanted to, again, build a tune around the bass line. So that's what we did. And I just started kind of messing around with this really crazy melody that I played really slow when I was doing it on Logic, and then started speeding it up to see what it sounded like.
And yeah, I've been trying to figure out that head and trying to sing it, and it's like, oh no, I need to have that slowed down.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that in the beginning, the tune was just going to be called Bad Hombres, you know, as a offshoot of Bad Hombre, of course. And then I gave it to Tana for her to study and to learn, and he's like, man, this thing is so hard. If I do it, you have to call it Bad Hombres y Mujeres. So I'm like, yes, of course. I will, you know. And she learned it. In the beginning, she would send me texts, like I would be on tour somewhere, and she would be like, I don't know if this is possible for me to sing. And I'm like, of course you can sing it. And then she practiced it enough, and she killed it.
Yeah, because that head,
yeah, it's not amicable.
Yeah, that melody. And then the other part that I really like is at the end, the kind of pulsing sort of Steve Reich,
mm-hmm,
kind of.
Yeah, I love that too. And, you know, the predictable thing would have been to, okay, somebody blow at the end, somebody do a little soloing or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, no, let's just groove out and not do much. You know? Just like a grid. We all get into that grid that is in 7-4, that ending. And we just go with it until, you know, we played way longer than you hear on the record because it was just so much fun just to play.
Maybe some years from now, there'll be a new album that'll have the outtake from that session with the, like, 40-minute version.
Yeah, I don't know how I would feel about that. Like, when I'm dead and somebody puts out all those recordings, I don't know. You didn't put them out for a reason, you know?
Yeah. That's what Creed Taylor, CTI, when those CTI reissues started coming out in the 80s and then subsequently after, he was angry that there were alternates and things on those because he felt like those shouldn't have been there for a reason. The same way Teo Macero thought that for Miles Davis, that some of those outtakes on the box sets shouldn't be there.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a little bit of a, I mean, if the person is dead already, that's even worse, you know, because it's like unauthorized necrophilia, musical necrophilia. So I don't know how I feel about that. You didn't put it out because you thought the best representation was not that.
Right.
But I don't know. But anyway, Bad Hombre was a really fun tune. And I wanted to, again, you know, for me, balance is paramount. You know, it's really, really important that the album has a flow. Even though people might not listen to the whole thing, you know, if you want to tell a story from beginning to end, and for me, storytelling is one of the most important aspects of music nowadays, and that's why some of my compositions are kind of long, because I love the cinematic development aspect of it. But Bad Hombre was, you know, I had to balance it out too with something in the record that is, you know, it has some meaning, of course, because of the title and where it came from. The phrase Bad Hombre,
mm-hmm,
but I wanted it to be a little more playful and not so just introspective like the rest of the record.